Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Stephanie Zenoff as my special expert guest. Stephanie Zenoff is a senior research scientist at the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. She has a BS degree in biophysics and MS, EE, and PhD degrees in electrical engineering and computer science. Her research interests span a wide spectrum of topics related to conversational systems, including phonological auditory modeling, computer speech recognition, statistical language modeling, natural language understanding and generation, discourse and dialogue modeling, and prosodic analysis. In recent years, Dr. Zenoff has focused her research interests towards biology, concentrating mainly on the relationship between nutrition and health. Since 2011, she has written over 24 papers in various medical and health-related journals on topics such as modern-day diseases and the impact of nutritional deficiencies and environmental toxins on human health. Good afternoon, Stephanie, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Thank you for having me.
Well, to begin with, we would just like to get to know you a little bit, a little more personably than, say, on your website bio. Maybe you could tell us something about your personal life, such as where you grew up and why you chose the education path that you decided to follow and how you evolved into the field that you currently work in.
Right, yeah. So I grew up mainly in Connecticut, New England, and I was always fascinated by science, almost any topic in science as a child, and I aspired to go to MIT from a pretty early age and study science. And so I did that. I got a degree in biology from MIT, undergraduate, and then went on to get my PhD in electrical engineering and computer science. At that time, of course, that field was brand new. And it was a good choice for me because I'm very mathematically oriented and I like numbers, you know. So I've had a very fun career, really, building systems that allow humans to communicate with computers using natural language. Precursors to things like Siri and Amazon's Echo, you know, if people know these products that you can now buy, it's really pretty exciting to see my work show up as a viable commercialization of it. But over the past 8 years, I've transitioned into using my skills in computer science and natural language to look at the biology and medical literature and also online databases to analyze correlations between disease and various toxic chemicals in the environment. And so I became interested in that because an interest in autism, I was observing what looked like exponential growth in the frequency, in the incidence of autism in the population going back to 1970, 1975. And exponential growth is a very scary thing. So 8 years ago, I was quite concerned about the growth. At that time, autism was still pretty rare, but it has continued to grow exponentially since that time. And this, to me, is quite terrifying, actually, because I see the projection of the curve that's been maintained for the past 20 or 30 years is going to give us 50% of the kids born in 2032 on the autism spectrum, and that will be 80% of the boys. So once we're there, it's not going to be viable. We're going to have to do something different. We need to figure out what is it that's causing this exponential growth, and that's what I set out to do 8 years ago.
So what have you discovered regarding the cause? I've seen the graphics in your seminars, the charts, they are frightening, and there seems to be tremendous controversy, tremendous resistance from convention as to what some of the theories are. But what have you uncovered through your research?
I have very, very clearly concluded that glyphosate is the major factor causing the epidemic. Glyphosate is probably something most listeners don't know what it is. It's the active ingredient in the pervasive herbicide Roundup, which you can go down to the hardware store and buy Roundup and use it to kill the weeds growing in your walkway. Roundup is considered a wonderful herbicide. It kills all plants except for those core crops that have been engineered to be Roundup resistant, so-called Roundup ready crops. This has been a great success in the GMO field of engineering these crops to be resistant to glyphosate so that you can just spray the poison on the crop. It won't die, but it does soak it up and gets into the food chain. So these are all the major crops that go into the processed foods, the corn, the soy, canola oil, sugar beets, alfalfa, tobacco, and cotton. I think that's pretty much the exhaustive list of Roundup ready crops. So what's happened is that every year you get more and more resistance from the weeds. You have to use more and more Roundup on the crop to kill the weeds. And this has been going on now for, well, since late 1990s when these crops were introduced. We have had a tremendous increase every year in the use of Roundup on these crops. And the government considers Roundup to be perfectly safe because Monsanto, who's the producer of it, assured them many years ago, this is a great herbicide because it kills all plants, but it doesn't harm us. And they were convinced. And so they don't measure it, they don't monitor it, they don't care. But it turns out when you look at this chemical and how it works, remarkably, you can explain all the complex features of autism on the basis of the known biological mechanisms of toxicity of this chemical.
So perhaps you could give us some insight. The glyphosate is being sprayed on the plants, and then they're processed and shipped and ultimately converted into foods. Are there residues? Is there a chemical change that occurs in the plant? What is your theory relating the detrimental effect actually on humans when they consume it?
Right, excellent question. It does show up in the foods, that's been shown. In fact, I've done research with Anthony Samsel. We've written many papers together, and he got about 8 different brands of dog food and cat food and sent them off to be tested for glyphosate, and every one of them came out positive. Even the high-quality, the high-end brands came out positive for glyphosate, certainly in the pet food, and they've shown that it's in soy. Anthony actually told me he's the one who got them to test the soy. They'll write a huge document on toxic chemicals used on food, and they'll leave glyphosate out because they consider it to be non-toxic. But he got them to do the soy in 2011. They did 300 samples of soy, and they found either glyphosate or its breakdown product, AMPA, in 96% of the samples that they looked at. So it's definitely in the food. It also messes up the food because it chelates metals and it prevents them from being taken up into the plant. So you get reduced value in the food that you eat. It's reduced in its mineral content, and that can end up with mineral deficiencies if you eat those foods. It's not clear what all else might be going on with those plants. There really has not been adequate studies done to see how else it messes up the plants. But the glyphosate itself is extremely toxic to human cells in insidious ways that have not been revealed. Whether Monsanto knows this or not, I don't know. But certainly from our research, it makes sense that glyphosate is disrupting human physiology as a consequence of its special property of being a synthetic amino acid. And amino acids are essential for life. There's 20 of them, and they're the genetic code. I mean, most people who know anything about biology know about amino acids. They're the building blocks of proteins. And glycine is a crucial, it's required. It's not an essential amino acid in the sense that the body can make it. But glycine plays many, many important roles in the body, many important roles, and one of which, of course, is in a protein. And glyphosate disrupts pretty much all the roles of glycine in the body, and that is just, over time, that becomes really devastating in terms of its effects. But it's chronic and insidious as opposed to acute and toxic. So you don't notice that you're being poisoned. You just slowly get sick.
Well, aside from the glyphosate, just the nature of what they're doing to the food, you know, the insertion, the alteration, the mutation, I guess, the Frankenfood idea, is that idea in principle okay with you if we did the proper research, or do you think we're moving in the wrong direction?
I have tremendous doubt about the safety of GMO foods, the actual engineering itself, but it's not as easy for me to prove that they're toxic, that the GMO itself is intrinsically toxic. Other people have done research in that area and have reached a conclusion that really bizarre things could be happening. It's very difficult biology to figure that out. To what extent can those genes maybe get into our genes? What kind of weird things could they do in terms of regulatory influences? Big, big questions that are really difficult to answer. And I mean, I remain sort of agnostic on the degree to which the GMO itself is damaging. I mean, I would not want to eat it. I eat 100% organic when we're at home. Of course, it's harder to do that when you eat out. But I certainly wouldn't want to be eating GMOs if I could avoid them. But I think it's the toxic chemicals that they allow. To me, that's where I've focused my research. And I'm convinced that that is a really serious problem that has been overlooked, for the most part overlooked, even by the research community.
Can I assume that you're against the position right now in the United States that there's no GMO labeling? Would you like to see the foods labeled?
Of course I would, absolutely. I'm really grateful that we do have the label certified organic, because I personally would not be happy with just GMO. I would have to go organic, because you do have crops. This is the other thing that's been happening more and more recently, is spraying non-GMO crops with glyphosate right before the harvest. Sugarcane, barley, oats, peanuts, lots of different crops are being sprayed as a desiccant to actually kill the crop right before the harvest. This is something I find very, very disturbing. And again, because the government considers it to be non-toxic, they don't worry about the fact that it's getting into the food. And I actually think this is a major source of gluten intolerance. We've got an epidemic in gluten intolerance today, and I think it's directly due to the practice of spraying wheat with glyphosate right before the harvest.
What about the relationship of immunization with children? I've heard you speak on this. Is there a connection there with autism?
Very much so. And in fact, I started with studying the vaccines because I knew that there were many mothers who were absolutely certain that their child was fine, developing normally. They got a vaccine, they had a severe reaction, high fever, maybe some seizures, and then they started regressing. They started losing the language skills they already had. It was very clear to the parent that the vaccine was the beginning of regression. And the parent is absolutely convinced the vaccine caused the autism. I think these parents are right. I think it's true. And I think there's been a major cover-up, particularly with respect to the MMR vaccine, which, of course, has a very interesting history with regard to Andrew Wakefield. He wrote a paper back in 1998, published in The Lancet. He was a gastroenterologist, very interesting, because he was concerned with children who had issues with their gut. And this is something I had identified early on, that autism is connected to gut disorder. This was one of my frustrations when I was studying the vaccines, because I spent really 5 years looking at aluminum. I looked at fluoride, you know, all these different toxic metals and lead, all these things, to try to figure out if one of them might be contributory to autism. And I found pretty strong link with aluminum at the time. But I was puzzled because I was looking at the vaccine database from the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is the VAR system that the U.S. government maintains of all these reports of people who've had some kind of adverse event that was sufficiently bad to be worth reporting. And I could see that aluminum-containing vaccines were much more toxic in the later years compared to the early years. And it's the same vaccine with the same amount of aluminum, but much more toxicity. And I was really puzzled by that. Why was the aluminum more toxic recently compared to today, the early 1990s? I've since reached the conclusion that aluminum, mercury, and glutamate are all synergistically toxic with glyphosate. So the presence of glyphosate in the food, in the air, in the water is making the vaccine much more toxic than it would otherwise be, because the glyphosate that's in your blood is working with chemicals in the vaccine, aluminum, mercury, and glutamate, to cause harm. And recently, I've even begun to believe that the MMR vaccine itself may sometimes be contaminated with glyphosate. And this is a direct possibility because MMR is a live vaccine. The live virus is grown on gelatin, and the gelatin is usually derived from things like the ligaments of cows, and the cows are eating GMO Roundup Ready corn and soy feed. It's been shown that glyphosate shows up in the tissues of these cows. That's been done in studies. So you can imagine that if you're taking those ligaments, and the ligaments contain a protein that has a high concentration of glycine. And my most recent research has shown that if you assume glyphosate can substitute for glycine in proteins, you can discover all kinds of explanations for why glyphosate would be highly correlated with a whole bunch of different diseases. Autism is one of them, but also obesity, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, all of these things begin to make sense if you assume that glyphosate can substitute for glycine in proteins. And so this means going all the way back to the MMR and the gelatin, which has a high concentration of glycine, there could be glyphosate there replacing the glycine in the protein and then being injected into the child and causing a horrendous reaction. So I can believe that may be a key part of the story in regard to the MMR toxicity that we're seeing.
Yes, referring back to Wakefield, we did an interview with him, and it was just a terrible set of circumstances, but it was nice to see him recently exonerated. He actually has been freed from that prison in terms of the discovery that the people that were trying to destroy him were found to be guilty and violating certain codes of ethics. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware of that, and I'm so pleased to know that. I know Andrew Wakefield personally. I really respect him. I have so much admiration for what he's gone through and how he has persisted in this field for so many years. It amazes me because when I go back and read his papers, he knew so much about what was going on with autism way back when. And because he got discredited, people ignored his work. I mean, here we are, you know, 15, 20 years later, still not knowing what's causing this autism epidemic and still just kind of blindly going along and letting it grow to the point where the country's going to be on its knees once we've got all these autistic kids. I mean, we're headed over a cliff. And it's just shocking to me that the solution the government does is to make sure that anybody who figures out what's actually causing the autism gets completely destroyed, you know, gets their career destroyed. That's the way we approach the problem. It's so crazy. I think it's insane.
What about yourself? Are you concerned? Have you stirred some controversy at MIT? Have you been approached by anyone or threatened in any way?
It's remarkable, actually. I know they're doing their best to discredit my work on the web, and they're probably succeeding in many cases. I think a person comes along, if someone tells them, oh, you should look at Stephanie Seneff's work, and they go and look and they find out I'm a quack, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. They'll say, well, I won't bother. I have other better things to do, and they won't, you know. So they're succeeding at some level in discouraging people from taking a closer look at what I have to say. I am absolutely convinced that I'm onto something huge here, and I think that I wish that more people would join the club. You know, I need a whole bunch of people to get on board to do the research. There's things that could be directly done by people who have the skills to do them. I don't have those skills to have a biology lab where I'm going to run experiments. Other people do, but they don't dare touch it because they're going to get their career destroyed. It's just so frustrating that people would rather, you know, not take that risk and make sure you know that risk is great. You know, I'm a young person with a bunch of small children. I'm not going to take that risk. I mean, people, you can understand they wouldn't want to make those personal sacrifices. But as a result, the entire society, you know, is going to be in huge trouble once we've got all these sick kids. And it's not just the autism, of course. It's also ADHD. It's all the allergies we're seeing. I mentioned the gluten intolerance, all the gut problems that kids have today, and the depression and food allergies and asthma, eczema. I mean, all these things are just increasing alarmingly in our population. The children are especially susceptible, and also, of course, the elderly, because they've been exposed all these years of accumulated glyphosate accumulates in the tissues. And so eventually you get into things like bone problems, joint problems, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS. All of these things are connected because glyphosate is a train wreck for the proteins, and the proteins have all these places were essential. Glycine is essential for the way that protein works. You put glyphosate in place of glycine, it doesn't work. And this is true for the amyloid beta that's in the Alzheimer's disease. It's incredible what it can do. And it's an accumulation over time of proteins that can't be broken down that have a glyphosate residue stuck in there in the wrong, you know, in place of the glycine. And eventually you just get really sick. I mean, it's scary. It needs to be removed from the planet.
Yes, I agree. I checked you out on Wikipedia just to prove my theory that anyone like yourself is usually condemned or criticized or has a very negative slant. And all of my other mentors in the field of natural alternative functional medicine, if you Google them and go to Wikipedia, there is always this sleight hand. There is this conservative, conventional, negative thrust towards them. Do you agree with that? And what is your position about young people that are using Wikipedia as a major source of data and information?
It's very frustrating. You know, and I know people who have tried, they'll see their Wikipedia page says something that's obviously painting them as being somebody you should ignore because they're just not credible. And they'll go in and try to fix it. And then very quickly, it's put back. Their stuff's taken out. The old stuff's put back. I mean, there's someone assigned, I think, the task of making sure that our web pages in Wikipedia portray us as lunatics, you know? It's really amazing. It's like the Inquisition with Galileo. I mean, we live in really incredible times where there's so much protection of the money that is to be made if you allow these chemicals to stay. The people who are doing this don't mind that all these kids are getting sick. This is what really, really shocks me, this lack of ethics and lack of morality. I'm just completely stunned, actually, by the situation that we're in right now. And I don't know how we can fix it. I really don't. We need more people who are willing to stand up to these folks, and we need the mainstream to recognize what's going on and to learn to dismiss these criticisms of the people who are trying to make a difference, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the ways we promote is to take a personalized, responsible approach to stay away from conventional thinking and to assign to yourself the responsibility of understanding biology and physics and the sciences. This is why when you talk about your love for science, I mean, I share the same love because I find today it's the only reliable, the scientific method. It's the only reliable way to really come to terms with what's going on. So what is your personal approach to diet? What do you do to protect yourself from all of this going on around you, this madness.
I know. It's hard, and I don't feel protected. I feel vulnerable because you really can't avoid it. You know, it's in the water, it's in the air, it's in the food. It's even in the organic food. I mean, they've tested organic food, and it was grown properly organically, but of course, it's in the manure. I mean, you can't avoid this stuff. It's everywhere. So I don't protect myself, but I do my best. As I said, when I'm shopping for food for eating at home, we are very, very careful to buy only organic. We even buy organic spices. We buy organic beer, organic wine. Everything is organic in our house, and we mostly eat at home. So every time we eat out, we're very careful to order the things that we think would have less. You know, we're doing a calculation as far as what's likely to have less and avoid the things that would be obvious targets. So that's what we do. I also eat a diet that's rich in nutritious foods, which, for example, you can get healthy eggs, and you have to be very careful with eggs because there's all kinds of different labels, and even organic eggs, you know, that's going to be a CAFO egg. You know, the egg is in a chicken that's confined to a nasty environment, being fed organic food, so even that's not necessarily good, you know. You want to have a cage free roaming. We try to buy the best eggs we can find, basically, because eggs are really a healthy food if you can get an egg from a healthy chicken, and seafood, eggs. And we like meat, but it has to be grass-fed. I think grass-fed beef is very healthy. We eat lots of green vegetables. We like to eat a lot of garlic and herbs, you know, basil and thyme and cilantro. I mean, all of these spices. Curcumin is a really good spice for helping to protect from Alzheimer's disease. So we eat a lot of spices and a lot of whole foods. We always cook from whole foods. We don't buy packaged foods, that kind of thing.
Sounds wonderful. Do you mind if Tracy and I invite ourselves over to your place for dinner?
Yeah, we're popular. My husband's a great cook, actually. He does the cooking in the family, and he's fantastic. He's so good, so I'm very fortunate.
Well, now, he must be on side with your line of thinking, and maybe you could talk about division in families, like not just spouses, but also with parents and brothers and sisters, how someone like yourself or myself, completely devoted to organic, fresh, whole, real food, and these people, our own family, think we're right off the wall. How do you deal with that? Is that your experience also?
It's very, very difficult. It is. And I have had some conflicts within my own family. And most of my kids are very good. I mean, it's been hard to convince them how important it is, you know, and they try. But, of course, it's very difficult with young children because there's just so many opportunities. And kids love Coke, donuts. It's just so difficult to say, no, you can't have this. It's frustrating, actually, that the world is so full of all these opportunities for disaster where it looks like the child would be just having a good time, you know, go out for a donut. I mean, a Dunkin' Donuts. How bad could that be? You know, it's just like it's very, very difficult to instill in your children the dangers that are lurking out there. So that's part of why I'm so driven, because I feel like I have to get the message out to the world so that my children will be convinced. But my children are pretty good in general. They're pretty good about trying to eat well, but they're not as conscientious as my husband and I are about eating 100% organic, but they're pretty good.
What is your take on dietary supplements? Do you take any? And if so, which ones do you like?
I don't take anything except for Epsom salt baths. I like Epsom salt baths. I would love to do a natural sulfur hot springs because I'm really, really into sulfur. That was where I started, actually. I recognized sulfur deficiency as being a major driver behind modern diseases. And I stayed consistent with that throughout my research. Long before I discovered glyphosate, I was concerned about sulfur. It turns out that especially the synthesis of sulfate and the distribution of sulfate. Sulfate is an oxidized form of sulfur with sulfur plus four oxygens and negative charge. And it is really, really essential for the health of the blood, for example. So the blood really depends upon sulfate to be able to flow properly. The red blood cells depend on sulfate to prevent them from coagulating. Sulfate protects from blood clots. It promotes blood flow. And glyphosate really disrupts the management of sulfate. It disrupts the synthesis of it. It disrupts the transport of it. And it encourages sulfate loss through the kidneys. So I think that systemic sulfate deficiency is a key underlying dysfunction behind multiple modern diseases. So it means eating sulfur, getting sulfur, but Epsom sulfate baths is an excellent choice to get sulfate because you soak it up through the skin. You're soaking up sulfate through the skin. It's magnesium sulfate, and that bypasses the whole complexity of getting the sulfate in through the gut, which is difficult to do.
Yes, you remind me of one of my teachers, Bernard Jensen, who's passed away now, the great naturopath from California. But he was all over sulfur, and he referred to it as the beauty mineral and associated life extension and health in many ways with the provision and consumption of organic, non-damaged sulfur. So that's really nice to hear you talk about sulfur. That's something that very few people ever bring up.
It is. It's interesting, actually, that sulfur seems to be a bit of a black hole, and we don't even have a minimum daily requirement for sulfur. There seems to be the assumption that there's plenty. And sulfur, it probably preceded oxygen, in fact, way back when life first developed, probably in the deep sea vents. It was probably sulfur-based. So even hemoglobin itself has sort of a history of an involvement with sulfur in the past, so it's really fascinating. Sulfur, it's in the same column as oxygen in the periodic table. Really interesting element that deserves far more attention than we've been giving it.
I guess that's where the healthy eggs come in, too.
It is. That's why I like to eat eggs, because they have a lot of sulfur. And seafood does, too, of course. And also the cruciferous vegetables, which we eat a lot of, like broccoli and cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and onions and garlic. We eat tons of onions and garlic. They both are a really good source of sulfur.
Well, that's a good word, Stephanie. Thank you so much. Now, I noticed you don't have a personal website, and I have listed your lab access and your bio on our webpage for you. Are there any websites that you advocate to our students that are into research that you think are just fabulous or essential to know about?
Well, I like Dr. Mercola. I tend to follow him. I think he has a lot of good advice about healthy living, so I would recommend Dr. Mercola. Other than that, if you want to learn more about me, you can. I don't have everything that I've ever done on my website, but you can type my name into a search engine and you'll get these various things that say that I'm a quack, but you'll also get various interviews like this one. I have done many podcasts and some video interviews and things of that sort. So there's a lot of material out there where I've tried to describe my position on what's going on in health these days.
Yes, well, Linus Pauling was a teacher, and of course, he's a big quack, too. And Abram Hoffer, another mentor of mine, all these people are quacks. So when I saw quack associated with your name, I realized, no, there's someone I really want to speak with.
I know, I'm starting to think that, you know, the more quack they are, the more I want to pay attention to them, you know, because they have more to lose if you've got something of value to offer, and therefore they're going to try harder to take you down. That's basically the way I see it. It's just really sad that that's the world we live in. And there's so much misinformation out there, too, as far as, I mean, because the whole thing about the low-fat diet, so crazy, because fat is really, really a healthy food, and especially cholesterol. And people are so terrified of their cholesterol levels that they try to go on a zero-cholesterol diet, which is a huge mistake, huge mistake.
So I guess you're an advocate of a sugar-free approach, you know, the refined sucrose and the fructose and all of that.
And those are all contaminated with glyphosate. When you think about it, so the high-fructose corn syrup comes from GMO Roundup Ready corn. The regular cane sugar, you know, comes either from the sugar beets or from the sugar cane, or the sugar cane is the cane sugar, but the sugar from sugar beets and sugar cane are both going to be contaminated with glyphosate. Sugar cane is sprayed right before the harvest. Sugar beets are GMO Roundup Ready. I mean, you don't win with sugar, you know, as far as glyphosate is concerned, unless you buy organic. So whenever we use sugar, we always buy organic sugar. Of course, we buy organic everything, but if you're going to buy organic, sugar is one of the first things you want to go organic with.
Yes, I agree completely, and also understanding what organic actually means, because as you well know, anything with carbon in it is organic, so that's a very loose term. And in Canada, I have some experience traveling and touring through the States. I think that our food supply is cleaner. I don't know why. It's just that we have less salmonella poisoning. We have less E. coli poisoning. We live in a small little town in a beautiful, pristine environment with lakes and lots of wildlife around. And I think that element of America is kind of shrinking as your population base obviously is much greater than ours.
I agree.
So the environment plays a huge role in our personal health too, doesn't it?
Right. And of course, the way they're growing the animals these days is so horrible. I mentioned the chickens and the chicken coop. I mean, it's the confined animal feeding operations, the cows, the pigs. It's just horrendous. And then they're feeding them the GMO Roundup Ready feed to go with that. So the animals are sick, and you can't imagine that their meat is healthy under those circumstances. It's really sad, because I feel that if you just got rid of all the cornfields of Iowa and you replaced them with grass and you put cows back out on the grass, you would have really healthy food, and you would really help the environment, because the grass actually needs the cows. The cows make the grass healthier. It's a natural ecosystem that works beautifully, and then you can fixate more carbon and more nitrogen into the soil and actually protect from global warming. So you're not only are you solving the food problem, you're making the cows healthy again, instead of just growing the corn and feeding the corn to the cows. You know, it's just so stupid what we're doing. If we just put the cows out on the grass, everything gets fixed, including global warming. You know, it helps to improve the situation with global warming.
Perhaps we all need to visit Aristotle in the Lyceum and get some lessons in logic.
Right. It's really sad that we have this whole industrialized attitude towards our agriculture and all these chemicals that we use on it. Of course, the chemical fertilizers as well. We don't use manure anymore. The manure is probably toxic because it's coming from these cows that are eating this horrible food. So we're really kind of stuck. The whole system is just completely busted, you know, and to fix it requires a huge overhaul to go back to the old ways of doing things that were much more natural.
Okay, so now looking at the animal kingdom, are you aware of any negative effect in regard to our discussion on this bee controversy? You know, the bee populations are diminishing worldwide. Is there a connection between your research and that phenomenon?
Yes, I think the bee crisis is entirely due to glyphosate working synergistically with the neonicotinoids. I really feel quite confident about that. The glyphosate is a major part of the bees' problem, and it's being ignored. I mean, even the experts are not saying that, but I believe it's true. A major part. There's very few people who are saying that. Don Huber, who is the one who actually introduced me to glyphosate, he's been saying it for quite some time. It became obvious to me because glyphosate disrupts the cytochrome P450 enzymes in the liver, and those enzymes are crucial for the bee to be able to detoxify the neonicotinoids. So the bee is getting synergistic toxicity because it can't break down the nicotinoids because the glyphosate has messed up the liver. That's what I think is happening. So the two chemicals are working together. And there's also a sort of like a bee autism or a bee Alzheimer's that's going on with respect to the glyphosate getting into the proteins, as I discussed in this session. Glyphosate substituting for glycine in proteins in the brain that's causing the brain to not function properly, and then the bees get confused and they can't come back, you know. So I definitely think glyphosate is a huge part of the bee problem, probably the most important factor. Also for the bats and for the starfish offshore, and also for bees that have the very long beaks, I can totally explain that. There's a problem with birds' beaks. I don't know if you've heard of that. But that's been showing up all around the areas where they have glyphosate-based agriculture, and it's due. I can see exactly why glyphosate would cause that.
Well, all I can say is that we got bees with Alzheimer's. I'm getting out of here. I want off this planet.
I know what you mean. I'm like, is there another planet I can move to, please? You know, it's really scary. You just feel so frustrated that it just keeps on happening and that it's not, people aren't picking up on it. You feel like, I know the answer, and why don't you guys just listen to me? You know, it's really frustrating. You see it happening all around you, and you're powerless to fix it, even though you know the answer already. It's so frustrating. You can't imagine.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie. Our time is gone. Thank you so much for your input and insight and some of the very bold statements you've made. We need to hear this, and I'm going to share this with everyone I know, and I want to thank you for your fearlessness and the pride that you have in computing, math, and science. I think this is something we all need to share. Would you mind sharing with us a final parting statement?
I would just urge everybody listening to really think in terms of buying only certified organic food. This will help to encourage the farmers to grow certified organic, and I think we can turn this whole thing around economically. We don't need the government to regulate what we eat. We just need the pocketbook to speak for itself, to say we want this healthy food, and if we demand it, then they will produce it, I believe, because they'll see that they'll get a better price for their product, and they won't have to subject themselves to the toxic chemicals. Farmers will one by one realize that it's better to grow organic. And of course, if you believe what I'm saying, tell your friends, tell your family, try to get everybody you know to also switch over to organic. That's how we're going to solve this problem, through the consumer interest, consumer demand. I think that's the way we're going to solve it.
Dr. Stephanie Zenoff is a senior research scientist at MIT with a recent focus on those elements and concerns relative to modern living and nutrition and diet. Stephanie, we thank you so much for your contribution and the time that you've given us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU. Sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with sports nutrition update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.